This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Coronavirus, Donald Trump, Brexit, Australia burning down. Who has time for climate change by 2030 or disappearing species? We get trapped in the all-encompassing now, but we must still plan for a future Earth, and that is what a team of leading world scientists say in a project called Future Earth's Global Risks Perceptions Initiative. Dr. Diana Liverman is a co-founder of Future Earth. She is an amazing scientist, a lead author in IPCC works from the Nobel Prize-winning 2007 report to the 2018 report on limiting warming to 1.5 degrees. Liverman is co-author of well over 100 refereed journal articles and book chapters. Diana is also a consistent voice for the concerns of women, the poor, and marginalized people. She is Regents Professor at the School of Geography and Development at the University of Arizona. From Tucson, Arizona, Diana Liverman, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thank you for talking to me.
Yes, well, let us begin with a conundrum that you raised in your presentation at the Nobel Conference 55 last September. The good news is huge progress in bringing 500 million people out of extreme poverty, reducing hunger, child mortality, the works, really positive gains in recent decades. But that success led to far more greenhouse gas emissions, and that brings unstable weather and an uncertain climate. Diana, can we escape from that trap where more development risks global ruin?
Well, it is a conundrum, and we do know that as millions of people came out of poverty over the last 25 years or so, that they did tend to consume more energy, consume more food, consume more water, and that is one of the reasons that greenhouse gas emissions went up. Although I will say that the poor, as they do come out of poverty, they're not the biggest emitters, of course. That's mostly the wealthy people in the population. But I think that there are ways in which we can bring out people out of poverty without increasing emissions or without increasing environmental impact. And it has to do with finding what I would call low-carbon pathways out of poverty. So if, as people start to have higher incomes, we can provide renewable electricity to them, for example. If we can provide them with healthy, sustainable diets, if we can find ways to reuse and recycle so that they can use water without causing water scarcity, all of those are things that we need to do. And one of the ways that's been captured is with the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, which seek to eradicate poverty and hunger, but at the same time reduce climate risks and reduce the impact that humanity has on ecosystems.
Diana, why was the group Future Earth founded?
Well, Future Earth is really a consolidation of a number of programs that were operating at the international level. So for several decades, there's been groups of scientists around the world under the International Council for Science coming together with concerns around climate, around biodiversity, around pollution. And Future Earth was created to bring all of those programs together under one umbrella and to link up with other international programs such as the United Nations Environment Program. And so when Future Earth was created, it was designed to be interdisciplinary, to take on some of these great environmental challenges. And one of the things that I particularly respect about the way Future Earth is moving forward is the way that it doesn't just look at natural sciences, it also looks at social sciences. And that's really important because, of course, it's people that are causing many of these environmental problems now, and it's people who are going to solve them.
So you have a larger report just out, Our Future Earth 2020. It's only 53 pages. It's easy to read by the public. I like looking at it. And the first chapter is by the UK science journalist and author Gaia Vince. But the second section comes from a unique survey of global scientists and the biggest risks that they see. Please tell us about that survey.
So that was a survey put together by Maria Ivanova and others. And they surveyed a number of scientists to look at which risks they ranked as most important. And in the responses to that survey, there were like five environmental and social risks that really emerged from all of the others that people listed. And those were climate change, extreme weather, which we get extreme weather irrespective of how much the climate is changing, and we can come back to that if you want. Biodiversity loss was the third big risk that they identified, and then the food crisis and the water crisis. So those five risks, there were just many, many of the more than 200 scientists that responded who really saw these five risks as the critical and urgent ones that we need to face. But the other point that many of the respondents made is that these risks are interacting. So, of course, the food crisis is partly caused by climate change. The biodiversity loss is partly caused by expansion of agriculture. So all five interact as well, mostly to make the crises worse because of the interactions between them.
Well, our listeners in the U.S. South that are flooded out by extreme rainfall, and certainly in the U.K. where they were just battered by Storm Dennis and record flooding in Wales, they're going to want to know what you were trying to say there about extreme weather and climate change.
So extreme weather is a problem even without global warming, and it's a problem partly because of human vulnerabilities and the way we've expanded our cities and our communities into areas that whenever there's an extreme event, they're going to get hit badly. So if you have more and more people living in floodplains, more and more people living on the coast, then hurricanes and floods are going to be more damaging just because there are more people there and more people who are vulnerable. But, of course, we also know from IPCC reports that climate change, global warming, with more energy in a warmer atmosphere, is likely to create more extreme weather. So a series of IPCC reports have now pointed out that with global warming, we can expect more extreme rainfall and more extreme drought. So it's as if, you know, the oscillation has gotten bigger. So people such as some of my colleagues where I used to work at Oxford are now doing a lot of work on what's called attribution, which is trying to figure out if an extreme weather event is caused by anthropogenic or human-caused climate change. And the way they report this is that there are increased chances of extreme weather because of global warming. So they don't say this event is climate change, but they're able to statistically and robustly show that the chances of this extreme weather are increased by climate change.
Now, previously, business and the news media generally relied on the annual Global Risks Report from the World Economic Forum. How is the Future Earth Survey different from that?
Well, it's done by scientists as opposed to corporate executives, although there are many corporate leaders who are pretty familiar with environmental science now. But one of the things that Future Earth is trying to do, and in writing our reports and doing our surveys, is to make sure that we're using the best scientific evidence to assess risks. And many of the scientists who are involved, like myself, have been involved in the big global scientific assessments, not only on climate change, but also, for example, some of the big global assessments on biodiversity. And in fact, this coming week, there's a big international biodiversity forum where they're going to be focusing on these very serious risks of biodiversity loss and trying to come up with some guidance about what our targets should be for reducing them.
And when you offer top scientists a menu of things to worry about, is there a single issue that tops their concerns? And if so, why?
I think it's climate change now. Almost everybody I work with and every report that comes out sees the climate emergency as the most urgent. And I think it's because, well, let me just say, when I first started studying climate change several decades ago, we were looking at something that would occur in the future. I think what's happened now is we're seeing climate change happening around us. We're seeing the fires in Australia. And we never wanted to see our projections come true, but now we're seeing the impacts of climate change that we had projected were going to happen several decades ago. And I think that's added to both the confidence that climate change is happening. I think the other issues are a sense of urgency. So the IPCC report on limiting warming to 1.5 degrees centigrade, that's 2.7 Fahrenheit for those who think that way, that report really pointed out that every little bit of warming matters. So there's a big difference in impacts between 1.5 degrees of warming and 2 degrees of warming. And I think many scientists are now recognizing that if we don't act very soon, then we're going to head for warming that is more than 1.5 degrees, more than 2 degrees, and as high as 3.5 degrees centigrade. And that will have very serious impacts on vulnerable human populations and on ecosystems. So there's a sense of urgency. And I also think there's a sense that there are solutions out there that we're not moving ahead on fast enough.
When I interview scientists on Radio EcoShock, there is a tendency to see their own field as the biggest challenge for the future. I mean, oceanographers emphasize the sea, of course, and foresters talk about the loss of forests, biologists, the loss of species. How do you avoid that pitfall in the new survey?
Well, I think it's probably there, but partially you avoid it by having a broad sample. You don't just interview the oceanographers. But I also want to, in a sense, defend scientists sort of caring most about their own field. It's not just that they've studied that field intensively and are absolutely confident about what they're seeing, but many scientists have been doing field work for decades. I know ecologists and oceanographers who, in addition to their science, they're also feeling, you know, genuinely sad and this great sense of urgency as they go back to their field areas and they've been burned or the species have disappeared. Or in my own case, I do a lot of field work and my students do field work with farmers. And it's really hard to spend time with farmers who are losing their crops and losing their livelihoods. So we often do care about the things that we study because we get, you know, very close to them.
Yes, I sensed that from Charlie Veron, who really named many of the world's corals and studied the reefs for his life and now has to chronicle the demise of the reefs, the Great Barrier Reef outside of Australia. I do notice that in the worry ranking by 222 leading scientists from 52 countries, an economic crash caused by a pandemic did not make it into the top five concerns. Maybe we will be blindsided by other unforeseen risks. What do you think, Diana Liverman?
Well, I think that's certainly a possibility. And it's also that the risk of epidemics interacts with some of these environmental risks. So, for example, in the report that Future Earth just produced, there's a section on health and climate change, which talks about some of the interactions between climate change and vector-borne diseases, but also there are concerns that some of the viruses that are coming from in tropical regions are emerging because we're cutting down the forest. So there are some intersections. But, I mean, I don't think that every scientist thinks that environment is the greatest risk in the short term. I think with many of these issues, although we're seeing an immediate crisis, the concern is for future generations. But of course, you know, economic collapse, epidemics, those are of great concern and can happen in an unpredictable way. But they will intersect with this sort of chronic degradation of the global environment. And it comes to this issue of vulnerability. I mean, if you have a lot of people who are sick, they're also going to be the people who are most vulnerable to climate change and extreme weather, who would be most vulnerable if food prices go up, would be vulnerable if water is more scarce.
So in the new Future Earth survey, scientists thought climate change, extreme weather, biodiversity loss, and water crises were most likely to occur, but not a food crisis, not as likely. Why do you think that is?
Well, food did emerge as one of the risks that was identified. But I think that, first of all, we can see quite a lot of solutions to our food crisis. I mean, one of the biggest ones is the amount of food waste. I mean, in the U.S., we waste more than a third of the food that's produced. If we reduce food waste, that would help a lot. There's also the solution, of course, which is being recommended, to move to more plant-based diets. And if one did that, there would be a lot more food available. And the other thing I would say, based on my own field work, is farmers are incredibly adaptable. They will respond, if they can, to drought, to extreme weather, to economic crises, and try to produce food. And one of the things that social scientists and development researchers will often say is that the problem isn't the amount of food, it's the distribution of food. And so if we can redistribute food, if we can reduce food waste, that crisis has some pretty immediate solutions that we can work on.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. Our guest from the University of Arizona is the well-known scientist, Diana Liverman. We're talking about how world scientists rank the risks we face in future Earth. We can all list major challenges to this civilization, if not to human survival itself, but these scientists add another dimension. Very different crises can feed back into other risks. As Diana has already told us, could you give us another example of how these feedbacks are worrying scientists, Diana?
You were asking me about feedbacks between environmental crises. And the point I wanted to make is, yes, there are feedbacks between crises. So, for example, climate change is one of the factors that is contributing to biodiversity loss. And if we take forests as part of biodiversity loss, then the loss of forests is contributing to climate change because they're not taking up CO2, and often they're being lost to burning, and that's putting carbon dioxide back into the atmosphere. So climate and biodiversity are very interactive. But I also wanted to mention the sort of feedbacks within each of the crises and the concern, for example, that as the planet warms, then there are feedbacks, like as the land in the Arctic melts and they lose frozen ground, then you get more methane, which is a gas that is also a greenhouse gas being emitted. Or as you get climate change, that's going to dry out the Amazon and you'll lose the trees there, and that could lead to a sort of feedback cycle of droughts. So there are feedbacks both between the environmental crises and of a crisis on itself.
Where does this survey of scientists go from here, Diana, once the short news attention has ended?
Well, I think that there's a drumbeat of scientific assessments that are underway right now. So we're about halfway through the next report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It'll come out in 2021. And there are hundreds of scientists right now assessing all of the latest research to see what is the latest we're finding on climate change and its impacts and the solution to it. And then at the same time, we have the group of ecologists and biodiversity scientists meeting, making research on this a priority, producing reports. And then Future Earth itself is supporting research and supporting networks that are addressing a number of issues. I think one of the things that's happening is people trying to focus on solutions. So whether it's the solutions to the biodiversity crisis in terms of protection and restoration of ecosystems, or whether it's looking at the solutions that we need to the climate crisis that a lot of scientists now are, and new groups of scientists are coming in with this strong focus on we need to find solutions. What research do we need? What evidence do we need for those solutions? So just because one report comes out, you know, scientists are doing research all the time, and many of them are focusing on these crisis issues and the solutions to them.
In 2019, you participated in a paper about transforming national meteorological and hydrological services into national climate service centers. I like the sounds of that. What is the vision there?
Well, what this is trying to do is that most countries, of course, have had weather services for a long time that do weather prediction and forecasting. And this is to add a climate dimension because, of course, climate is a shift in the average of the weather rather than any individual weather event. So the idea behind climate services is to either add a component to a weather service or create a separate climate service where stakeholders, farmers, water managers can go to get information about what is happening to the climate, but also things like who's vulnerable. So we've done this for disaster response for many decades, but now we're actually trying to create systems where people can get information about how the climate is changing now, how it might change into the future, and also strategies for adapting to those climate changes. So I've been involved in projects in the Caribbean. I've been talking to people in Guatemala, and also in a number of European countries, they're establishing climate services to help people respond to ongoing climate change.
Well, it would be wonderful to see the TV weatherman go that extra step further and say, well, yes, it's record hot, and that's another sign of climate change. They seem to leave that last part of it out.
Well, some do. There was a study a few years ago that suggested that some of the meteorologists, TV meteorologists, were a bit skeptical about climate change. But I think that's changing with the observations of what's happening. And my local weather people do mention climate change when it's relevant. And they do come to events where we're talking about climate change. So I do think that the meteorological community is now pretty much on board with climate change being a problem and something that their listeners and users want to hear about.
And you were also co-author of a 2019 report from the IPCC, a task force on gender. Could you give us just a couple of snapshots from that?
Oh, yes. So as your listeners, I'm sure, know, there's been questions and concerns about women in science and the extent to which they've experienced barriers or discrimination. And we still don't have an equal balance of men and women in science, even though girls often do better than young men in science in their early years. So one of the things that a group of us decided to do was to take a group of the world's leading climate scientists, who would be many of those who contribute to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and survey both men and women to see whether they felt that there were problems within the IPCC. And we found that, yes, a number of the women who responded felt as though they hadn't been heard, that they faced barriers because they were caring for children or for elderly parents, that there was still not a good balance of men and women. So the first IPCC report in 1990, there were more than 100 men and only 3 women who were authors. And that's improved over time. Now about a third of the IPCC authors are women. But both men and women feel as though there is opportunity for even further balance. And one of the exciting results of the report that we wrote on gender balance in IPCC is that the IPCC is now adopting a gender and inclusion policy, which includes, for example, sensitivity training as part of meetings and making sure that the leadership of IPCC is balanced between men and women. But I will say that the majority of women have not felt as though they've had problems in the IPCC. They feel as though the problems and barriers they've encountered have been more generally in their career and a part of the sort of more general problems that we find in science.
Diana Liverman, your PhD dissertation at the University of California was titled "The Use of a Simulation Model in Assessing the Impacts of Climate on the World Food System." Now, today that would not be remarkable, but that was 1984. What got you on this essential track so early?
Boy, you've really done your research into my deep career history. So I got interested in that because when I was a graduate student, I was very concerned about drought and its impact on the poor in places like Africa and Latin America and how they became vulnerable. And then I started hearing about climate change, and I had an amazing chance to do a research fellowship at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, which is in Boulder, Colorado. And when I went to NCAR, people were just starting to talk about climate change, and I was very influenced by a guy called Steve Schneider, who is a very famous climatologist, very inspiring. Unfortunately, he died too soon. But Steve got me interested, and he said, well, if you're interested in the link between drought and hunger, why don't you take a look at some of these projections of climate change? And that is what I decided to do. And there was a group of us who were students there in the early 80s, and everybody's gone on pretty much to a career looking at climate change. But at that point, hardly anybody was interested in what we were doing. And it's sort of amazing now to be living in a world where so many people are concerned and there are so many researchers looking at the issue.
Should scientists feel obligated to always try to give us optimism along with the bad news? What do you think?
Well, I'm a teacher as well as a researcher, and I teach large undergraduate courses at the University of Arizona. I love teaching. And a few years ago, I heard that some of my students were calling my intro course Environmental Depression 101 instead of Environmental Conservation. And I realized I can't keep teaching these young people that, you know, we're heading for the apocalypse. So I try very hard now to include hope. Not sort of false hope, but real examples of solutions in all of my lectures. And in terms of my research, there are signs of hope. There are changing attitudes. There are changing technologies. There are changing policies that are moving us in the right direction most of the time. But it's really in my teaching that I feel an obligation to try to give my students hope for the future and not feel sort of depressed and anxious about where they're going.
As we wrap up here, is there anything else that you would like to say to our listeners?
Well, I think one thing I would say is I don't want people to panic. One of the things that I felt bad about after the IPCC report came out was, you know, people contacting me and saying, is it too late? Is the world going to collapse in 12 years? Is that what the IPCC said? And I want people to know that it's a serious problem and we need to act. But I don't think people need to feel personally as though things are going to come to an end and that they should be worrying about the future of their children unnecessarily. I think people have to act. They have to act fast and they have to act calmly, but they shouldn't give up hope.
We have been speaking with Dr. Diana Liverman, professor of geography at the University of Arizona and co-founder of Future Earth. You can find links to Our Future on Earth 2020 and the new survey of world scientists at futureearth.org. As always, I'll put detailed links in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. Diana, thank you so much for sharing your time with Radio EcoShock listeners.
You're very welcome.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.